sales boost from families in lockdown. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,289. Ector County negative, 19,342 out of 23,891 tested, with 260 pending, 71 deaths. Recovered, 3,492. Active, 726. Midland County, 3,272 confirmed, 69 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, COVID-19 hospitalizations, new daily cases, dropped to lowest point since June. 4,144 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 1st, 763 less than a week ago. They occupy 7.6% of hospital beds. 4,116 new cases were reported on September 1st. The latest positivity rate is 10.1%. 12,681 Texans have died as of September 1st, 145 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,105 more than a week ago. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The U.S. continues to lead the world in total coronavirus cases with more than 6 million infections. Iowa has the highest rate of coronavirus cases in the U.S., a White House Coronavirus Task Force report sent to state officials warned. A National Institutes of Health panel says doctors should not treat convalescent plasma as a standard of care for COVID-19 until more studies have been done. Citing fears that increased homelessness could exacerbate the coronavirus crisis, the Trump administration on Tuesday issued a ban on evictions for the next 4 months. But housing experts say the policy doesn't go far enough, since it doesn't provide any aid for renters who will eventually owe what may be sky-high past due balances. The Trump administration said it will not join a global effort to develop, manufacture, and equitably distribute a coronavirus vaccine, in part because the World Health Organization is involved. The U.S. coronavirus death toll has surpassed 181,000 and more than 6 million cases have been reported. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin testified before Congress on Tuesday that a new stimulus package is still needed, but talks with Democrats after the hearing went nowhere. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is facing criticism for visiting a hair salon in San Francisco that was closed to the public due to coronavirus restrictions. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio announced he would delay the start of in-person school by nearly 2 weeks after teachers threatened to strike over safety concerns. Now here are longer articles. Common steroids reduce deaths among critically ill COVID-19 patients, new analysis confirms. New research released on Wednesday confirms that common affordable steroids can reduce deaths among critically ill COVID-19 patients. The study, published in the medical journal JAMA, examined several randomized trials involving more than 1,700 patients. Patients who received the steroids were more likely to survive, and there was no suggestion of an increased risk of serious adverse events among those who received the drugs. Among 678 patients treated with steroids, 32.7% died. Among 1,025 patients who received the usual care or a placebo, 41.5% died. The bottom line is that these are the sickest patients who are being treated with corticosteroids in these trials, and mortality is very high. It's about 40% in the absence of treatment with corticosteroids, said Jonathan A.C. Stern of the University of Bristol, an author of one of the papers published Wednesday. The treatment with corticosteroids reduces mortality of 40% to 32%. That's a 20% relative reduction, or if you like to have a better way to think about it, an easier way to think about it, is that out of every 100 patients treated with corticosteroids, 8 additional patients do not die. These results suggest steroids should be part of standard care for critically ill COVID-19 patients, the study says. COVID-19 cases in U.S. children have increased 17% over 2 weeks, report says. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic through August 27th, there have been more than 476,000 cases in children, according to an updated report published by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. The report looks at publicly reported data from 49 states, New York City, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam. Children represented 9.5% of all cases, and there is an overall rate of 631 cases per 100,000 children in the population. Both of these numbers have increased since the previous report on August 20th, when children represented 9.3% of all cases, and the overall rate was 583 cases per 100,000 children in the population. There were 70,330 new child cases reported since August 13th. That's a 17% increase in child cases over 2 weeks. Of the 9 states that reported testing, children make up between 4 and 13.3% of all tests. Between 2.8 and 17.4% of tested children were positive for COVID-19. At this time, it appears that severe illness due to COVID-19 is rare among children, the report says. However, states should continue to provide detailed reports on COVID-19 cases, testing, hospitalizations, and mortality by age so that the effects of COVID-19 on children's health can be documented and monitored. It's the worst thing you could do, Fauci says of sending infected children home from college campuses. College students infected with the novel coronavirus should stay on campus and isolate there as opposed to returning home, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci. A return to campus for the new academic year has colleges and universities struggling to both contain outbreaks of COVID-19 and enforce policies meant to prevent its spread. Keep them at the university in a place that's sequestered enough from the other students, but don't have them go home because they could be spreading it in their home state, Fauci said during a pre-recorded interview on NBC's Today Show on Wednesday. Asked if campuses should be shut down when there are infected students to send kids home, Fauci replied, "It's the worst thing you could do." You don't want to be someone who's propagating the outbreak, Fauci warns ahead of Labor Day weekend. Holiday weekends have led to surges in COVID-19 cases, but practicing mitigation measures can help prevent these surges, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci. When you have a holiday like Labor Day, we have seen after the 4th of July, we saw after Memorial Day, a surge in cases, Fauci said during a pre-recorded interview on NBC's Today Show on Wednesday. Wear a mask, keep social distancing, avoid crowds. You can avoid those kinds of surges. You don't want to be someone who's propagating the outbreak. You want to be a part of the solution, not part of the problem, Fauci said. Coronavirus symptoms can last much longer than initially thought, experts say. Months into the pandemic that has infected more than 6 million Americans, the public and experts alike are learning the impacts of COVID-19 can drag on longer than expected. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advises that most Americans who have tested positive for coronavirus can return to work or school 10 days after the onset of symptoms, unless the illness requires hospitalization. But new research suggests that the virus and its symptoms are often nowhere near finished by that benchmark. According to research published Tuesday in the British Medical Journal, patients may need to wait over a month before being retested to know whether they have cleared the virus. The study also suggests that about 1 in 5 negative tests are false negatives, meaning that many are still spreading the virus after testing negative without knowing it. Even once patients do test negative, many report that their symptoms, from aches to loss of smell to brain fog and affected mood, can last months longer. We think that this long-term damage may be in part due to vascular damage, kind of a footprint that the virus leaves even when it's gone from the body, Dr. William Lee told CNN's Chris Cuomo earlier in the week, adding that researchers have seen the virus damaging blood vessels that connect the entire body. The unspoken long-term coronavirus symptoms. It's been almost 5 months since Shelby Hedgecock tested positive for COVID-19, and the former personal trainer said her symptoms are still debilitating. Hedgecock is among patients who call themselves long-haul survivors, those who experience symptoms long after testing positive. And long-term effects like theirs needs to be taken seriously, a doctor researching these symptoms told CNN on Monday night. This is the conversation that needs to be had in the medical and the research community, not just in the sufferers who are actually dealing with it, Dr. William Lee said. COVID-19 can be a prolonged illness, even among young adults without underlying chronic medical conditions, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported in July. About 35% of patients surveyed by the agency said they still weren't back to their usual good health, even 2 to 3 weeks after testing positive for the disease. The rest said they had returned to their usual state of health about 5 to 12 days after a positive test. Hedgecock first tested positive in April, and though she tested negative in May, she is still having neurological issues, cognitive issues, shortness of breath, chest pain, loss of smell, and body aches and pains that send her to bed for days if she participates in even gentle yoga, she told CNN. Hedgecock's experience is not unique, Lee said. His team is trying to connect the symptoms, with data pointing to the virus not just affecting the lungs, but the blood vessels that connect the whole body, the doctor said. We think that this long-term damage may be due in part to vascular damage, kind of a footprint that leaves the virus even when it's gone from the body, Lee said. Now, here are a few short articles related to the vaccines. There's a legitimate way to end coronavirus vaccine trials early, Fauci says. A COVID-19 vaccine could be available earlier than expected if ongoing clinical trials produce overwhelmingly positive results, said Dr. Anthony Fauci. Although two ongoing clinical trials of 30,000 volunteers are expected to conclude by the end of the year, Fauci said an independent board has the authority to end the trials weeks early if interim results are overwhelmingly positive or negative. The Data and Safety Monitoring Board could say, "The data is so good right now that you can say it's safe and effective," Fauci said. In that case, researchers would have a moral obligation to end the trial early and make the active vaccine available to everyone in the study, including those who have been given placebos, and accelerate the process to give the vaccine to millions. Fauci's comments come at a time of growing concern about whether political pressure from the Trump administration could influence federal regulators and scientists overseeing the nation's response to the novel coronavirus pandemic and erode shaky public confidence in vaccines. Prominent vaccine experts have said they fear Trump is pushing for an early vaccine approval to help win re-election. Large Icelandic study finds that antibodies last for months in boost to vaccine search. A new large-scale study out of Iceland found that coronavirus antibodies lasted for at least 4 months, a potentially encouraging development for scientists working on a vaccine. Published Tuesday in the New England Journal of Medicine, the study used blood samples from more than 30,000 people. Of those who tested positive for the coronavirus, 487 had received multiple antibody tests, allowing scientists to compare the results over a period of time. In the first 2 months after a patient was diagnosed, the antibodies that can confer immunity rose significantly, they found. For the next 2 months, antibody levels remained stable. In a separate commentary, scientists from Harvard University and the National Institutes of Health noted that the Icelandic study focused on a homogeneous population largely from a single ethnic origin and geographic region, and that results might vary elsewhere. That said, this study provides hope that host immunity to this unpredictable and highly contagious virus may not be fleeting and may be similar to that elicited by most other viral infections, they added. Previous studies had suggested that coronavirus antibodies might be short-lived, leaving people vulnerable to reinfection. The new findings, however, offer hope that a vaccine that triggers an immune response will have a longer-lasting effect than some had previously theorized. The Icelandic researchers also found that women, non-smokers, and older patients had higher levels of antibodies, as did those with more severe cases of COVID-19. Public trust around coronavirus vaccines is dropping quickly, researcher says. Public trust around coronavirus vaccines is dropping quickly, according to Dr. Seema Yasmin, a former CDC disease detective who is tracking this in real time. I have concerns about how the trials for vaccines are being communicated, she said about her observations from her work on misinformation and disinformation, particularly around vaccines. In a recent interview, Dr. Fauci said a COVID-19 vaccine could be available earlier than expected if ongoing clinical trials produce overwhelmingly positive results. Dr. Yasmin agrees. However, she points out that it will not lead to widespread usage if there is no public trust. What use is that if the American people are like, nope, I think you did this too quick. You named it warp speed. That's really terrifying. Did you cut corners? How safe is this really? She said. My concern is that dropping credibility in science and scientists in the FDA, which already this year has fast-tracked two emergency use authorizations, and very questionably, she added. Some background. Three COVID-19 vaccine candidates are in large-scale U.S. trials. British drug maker AstraZeneca said Monday it has started phase three trials of its experimental coronavirus vaccine in the U.S., becoming the third company to start late-stage trials of a vaccine to prevent COVID-19. The vaccine, developed in partnership with Oxford University, has the backing of the U.S. federal government. Rivals Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech already have phase three trials underway, also with the federal funding. The World Health Organization cautioned countries Monday against rushing to develop coronavirus vaccines and advised taking great care in granting emergency use authorization, a quicker route to getting a vaccine in wide use than full approval, which can take many months. Sniffer dogs to be trained in Finland amid hopes that they can detect coronavirus at Helsinki Airport. A Finnish group is training sniffer dogs amid hopes that they could help spot travelers infected with the novel coronavirus. I'm going to try carefully to pronounce this name. Evidencia Elaine Lakara Palivlut, a Finnish veterinary clinics network, said it would fund an initial trial program to train 16 dogs with 10 trainers expected to be deployed at Helsinki Airport. I felt the need to do something, Virpi Perala, a representative for the clinics network, told the Washington Post. Perala said more funding would be needed to scale the project up if it is successful. We need a lot of dogs, possibly hundreds. The first dogs could be deployed to the airport within weeks, she said. Finland would not be the first country to put hopes in sniffer dogs' capability to spot signs of the coronavirus. Various experiments are underway in the United States and other countries. Some nations have already deployed dogs to curb the spread of the virus. In Dubai, health experts have had sniffer dogs analyze sweat samples of randomly picked air travelers since mid-August. According to researchers, the dogs detected the coronavirus with a 94.5% accuracy. The practice rests on the theory that changes in health, such as getting sick by a virus, affect the way people smell, and that dogs have sensitive enough noses to notice. Research by the University of Helsinki earlier this year found similarly promising indications, even though scientists there have said only large-scale trials can conclusively prove whether the method works. Like in Dubai, the dogs will sniff sweat samples and will not come into contact with travelers. The infrastructure to support the trial is currently being set up, said Anna Heilm-Jortman, a researcher at the University of Helsinki. Travelers who agree to the dog sniff test will swab their own necks to produce a sample for the dog's scrutiny. She added, the dogs may be better at spotting coronavirus infections than PCR and antibody tests, according to their preliminary research. The dogs can also find individuals that are not yet PCR positive, but will become PCR positive within a week, said Helm Bjorkman, referring to pre-symptomatic individuals. Helm Bjorkman said the dogs could later also be used in nursing homes and other places. After a first wave of infections in the spring, Finland saw cases plummet during the summer, mostly with either no daily new cases or increases in the single digits. In recent weeks, the country of 5.5 million has seen an uptick in new cases, with daily increases in the low double digits. Now here are a few articles related to the economy. Ford will cut 1,400 salaried jobs and offer early retirement. Ford is looking to cut 1,400 white-collar jobs in a cost-savings move. The automakers sent out letters to employees Wednesday saying that salaried staff eligible for retirement would be getting early retirement offers next week. Those who take the offer by October 23rd would be leaving the company by the end of the year. Our hope is to reach cost-cutting targets with the voluntary incentive program, the letter from Kumar Galhotra, Ford's president of the Americas, said. If that doesn't happen, involuntary separations may be required. The auto industry has been hit hard by the economic downturn associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. Car sales are down significantly as millions of U.S. workers have lost their jobs, and millions more are working from home and not in need of a new car to get to and from work. Ford posted a 50% drop in revenue in the second quarter, and it would have lost $1.9 billion in the period without a paper gain from its investment in Argo Al, a separate company working on self-driving car technology in which Ford and Volkswagen have a joint stake. The company has 30,000 salaried U.S. staff and 56,000 U.S. hourly factory workers. It had 190,000 employees worldwide at the start of the year. It has not had any layoffs of hourly workers this year, unlike rival General Motors, in response to the drop in sales from the COVID-19 pandemic. Ford said its cost-cutting move is part of a five-year, $11 billion restructuring that was first announced 2 years ago. Most of the job cuts from that effort is expected to be focused on less profitable overseas operations. Ford stock was flat Wednesday morning. World's largest movie theater chain will reopen another 140 theaters by Friday. AMC said that 70% of its theaters, or 420 total, will be open by this weekend, including the first AMC theater in San Diego, California. AMC announced Thursday that it will reopen more than 140 theaters this week. This move comes right before the movie Tenet comes out in the U.S. this Labor Day weekend, one of the first big movies to hit theaters since the pandemic began. The Christopher Nolan film had a big international debut last weekend. The film was originally set to open in July, but was delayed because of continued uncertainty. Major theater chains are attempting to reopen during the pandemic, but it's difficult to entice audiences to return to theaters without a new major blockbuster to sell tickets. Some background. AMC first reopened more than 100 theaters in the U.S. on August 20th. AMC CEO Adam Aron said in a statement that the first 2 weekends of operations have exceeded our expectations in terms of guests returning to the movies. Aron added that the company will continue to reopen theaters in a way that is both responsible and welcoming. The world's largest movie theater chain says it expects to make more announcements about additional theater reopenings in California, New Jersey, and other areas of the country in the coming weeks. ADP employment figures disappoint as government report looms. The ADP employment report released today was worse than expected, as just 428,000 jobs were added last month. Economists had predicted 950,000 new jobs in the private payrolls report for August. The report showed that large companies had the strongest job gains, with the leisure and hospitality sector gaining 129,000, the most of any. The spring lockdown decimated the industry as hotels and restaurants shut their doors while flights were grounded. What this means. For those watching these figures as an indicator for Friday's government jobs report, disappointment could be on the horizon. Economists expect 1.4 million jobs to be added to the economy in August, bringing the unemployment rate to 9.8%. It would be the first time since April that the jobless rate is below the peak of the Great Recession. July's job data showed the U.S. labor market's third straight month of solid improvement from the depths of the pandemic. However, millions of Americans who lost their jobs at the beginning of the pandemic remain unemployed. Economists are worried that the tepid recovery in the U.S. job market could run out of steam this fall should coronavirus cases surge again, just as federal stimulus money runs out. The world's top developed economies are all officially in a recession. What happens next is far from certain. Lego receives sales boost from families in lockdown. The pandemic has delivered an unexpected boost to Lego, which saw sales rise by 14% during the first 6 months of 2020 as families on lockdown sought out new forms of indoor entertainment. We saw a very positive development during the coronavirus lockdown when families began playing and building Lego sets together, Chief Executive Niels Christensen told Reuters. That trend appears to have continued into the second half of the year, even after people started going back to work and to school, he added. In recent years, competition from smartphones and apps have led to diminishing profits for toy makers. Before the novel coronavirus spread worldwide, Lego had expanded its marketing to target stressed-out adults, suggesting that building with plastic blocks could deliver a sense of mindfulness. As stress levels and quarantine boredom continue to rise, the Danish company witnessed a sudden increase in online sales that was significant enough to make up for the temporary closure of hundreds of stores, executives said Tuesday. Visits to the company's e-commerce site doubled in the first half of 2020 compared to the same period a year earlier. Lego's revenue grew by only 7% as sales surged during that same time period, an imbalance that the company attributed to shutdowns of factories in Mexico and China. Now I'm going to play an article that I originally read last Thursday for our San Angelo Standard-Times newspaper broadcast that runs on Fridays. This is an interesting article about a West Texan who is actively helping in vaccine development for coronavirus. Here's that story. The articles I'll be reading now were published Tuesday, August 25th. San Angelo is on the front lines for a coronavirus vaccine, thanks to a former resident. Area residents can volunteer for trials happening at Benchmark Research. By John Tufts. Mark Lacey believes a vaccine for COVID-19 will be produced within the next 12 months, and San Angelo will have played a crucial role in its development and possibly in its discovery. Lacey, who was born and raised in San Angelo and who graduated from Central High School in 1978, is now the CEO of Benchmark Research, a clinical research company based in Austin. The company has 5 locations across the United States, which include Fort Worth, San Angelo, New Orleans, and Sacramento. In July, Benchmark Research began clinical trials for a COVID-19 vaccine in the Concho Valley, in which up to 300 residents have so far participated. Lacey hopes to eventually have 10,000 participants from the San Angelo area to help researchers develop a vaccine to the coronavirus. We're one of the only companies in the United States that are involved in all of the trials that the federal government has considered to have the best promise to produce a COVID-19 vaccine, Lacey said. It makes me very proud that San Angelo can participate in possibly changing the world. Helping to change the world through medical research is something San Angelo residents have already done, whether they're aware of it or not. In its 20-plus years of operation, Benchmark Research's past studies have investigated vaccines for the H1N1 influenza during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, as well as the Ebola virus during the 2014 Ebola virus epidemic. San Angelo is helping to find medicine to keep people healthier longer, Lacey said. San Angelo residents have participated in at least 20 groundbreaking studies that are saving millions and millions of lives. Other studies Benchmark Research is conducting include combating bioterrorism. Lacey said San Angelo is one of 3,200 cities in the United States that have participated in ways to counteract smallpox and other deadly pathogens that could be released during a terrorist attack. To do this kind of research and to find a vaccine for COVID-19, Lacey stressed the need to have volunteers who are willing to participate in clinical trials. "It's critical we have volunteers," Lacey said. "It's very likely that within the next 12 months, we will find a vaccine, and San Angelo has an opportunity to be a part of the solution." Lacey said residents living in San Angelo have participated in more than 200 vaccine studies, and those who do so are paid for their time. Compensation varies according to the level of participation, but Lacey said the maximum amount is up to $1,500 for each participant. How close are we to discovering a vaccine? While researchers are getting closer to discovering a vaccine for COVID, it's too soon to presume victory that a vaccine is imminent, according to a group of USA Today panelists who work in medicine, virology, immunology, logistics, and supply chain issues. There's a possibility none of the current vaccine candidates will pan out. The typical success rate for vaccine development is 6%, according to The Lancet, a British medical journal. "We simply cannot assume the outcome at this stage," said Dr. Kelly Moore, Associate Director of Immunization Education with the Immunization Action Coalition. With at least 10 possible vaccines now in the final Phase 3 clinical testing stage, two looming questions remain. Will they work, and will they work long enough? There's no data to show that any of the candidate vaccines provide immunity to COVID-19. That's what Phase 3 clinical trials test for, which are now only starting. "This is a new virus, and we are just beginning to unravel the protective immunity," said Parkash Nagarkoti, an immunologist and vice president for research at the University of South Carolina. Who can volunteer for COVID-19 trials in San Angelo? Officials with Benchmark Research said that before joining a clinical trial, a participant must qualify for the study. Some research studies seek participants with illnesses or conditions to be studied in the clinical trial, while others need healthy participants. For COVID-19 vaccine studies, Benchmark Research officials said they are looking for participants who are highly likely to be or have been exposed to COVID-19, including those at risk for severe illness. This includes people who work in occupations that put them in regular contact with the public, such as nurses, doctors, construction workers, teachers, retail staff, delivery drivers, and other essential workers. High-risk individuals, including those above age 65, and those who suffer from health conditions such as obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and asthma, are also eligible to participate, officials said. Those interested in volunteering can visit Benchmark Research online and fill out a pre-screening form here. benchmarkresearch.net/participate. For more information, call 1-888-902-9605. Or visit Benchmark Research at their San Angelo location at 3605 Executive Drive. CEO says you can't get COVID from vaccine study. Lacey stressed clinical trials pose little risk for volunteers developing COVID-19. "The vaccine is made of dead, attenuated viruses, so there is zero chance in getting COVID, Lacey said. We've enrolled 28,000 patients over the last 15 years for vaccine studies, and we have yet to have one serious adverse health effect related to the drug. There are benefits and potential risks for participating in clinical trials, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Officials say it's possible you may get a new treatment for a disease before it's available to the public, but the new treatment could cause serious side effects or be uncomfortable. The history of clinical research is not perfect. Based on many years of experience and learning, Congress has passed laws to protect study participants. Today, every clinical investigator is required to monitor and make sure that every participant is safe, according to a statement made by U.S. health officials. If and when a vaccine for the coronavirus is eventually found, officials say it might take some convincing for residents wary of vaccines in general. The agencies that decide if a vaccine is ready and who gets it first are the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is vital that the U.S. government communicate clearly with the American people about the data and science behind any new COVID-19 vaccine, said Dr. Michelle McMurray-Heath, president and CEO of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. Lacey appeared to agree and encouraged people to proportion their opinions about vaccines based upon the available science. Everybody has a right to their own beliefs, but I believe what you should go by are the facts and the science, and not by rumors or innuendo, Lacey said. More about Mark Lacey. Lacey said he comes from a long line of San Angelo and Miles area businessmen. His grandfather owned several businesses in San Angelo, including a funeral home, and his father owned Harvester and Deer dealerships. I have a degree from the University of Texas, and I attended school in Germany for a year as an exchange student, Lacey said. I was also a special assistant to the Secretary of Transportation under Ronald Reagan. Officials with Benchmark Research said Lacey has worked in commercial real estate in Manhattan, and he later founded a company that performed communications audits. Eventually, he teamed up with a business partner with a background in clinical research and suggested they start a company focused on clinical research trials. In 1997, Benchmark Research opened a location in Fort Worth. 2 years later, Lacey opened a branch in San Angelo, his hometown. I wanted to bring back jobs to San Angelo, Lacey said. It makes me proud that San Angelo has representation in the international research industry. Now we're going to bring you our pre-recorded reports that we have for you today. And we have very little time for all the reports I'm going to try and bring you today. So rather than introduce each one individually, I'm going to tell you now what they are going to be without interrupting them. The first one is from the Texas Standard. It was published earlier this week. With few eviction protections remaining, Texas could face a housing crisis of epic proportions. And then our next article will be from NPR that was published yesterday. CDC issues sweeping temporary halts on evictions nationwide amid pandemic. Following that is another Texas Standard report. Data discrepancies hinder Texas's contact tracing efforts. And our final report from NPR today is for Colorado 4-H kids, the livestock show goes on despite the pandemic. Here are those reports.
A lot of people struggling to cover bills right now in Texas. In July, a federal eviction moratorium expired. It didn't cover every rental unit, didn't even cover most, but it did prevent some landlords from evicting tenants as the economy collapsed. KERA's Christopher Connolly explains why housing experts are warning a wave of evictions is imminent.
Stuart Campbell thinks this fall could get bad, like really bad. He's a housing attorney for Legal Aid of Northwest Texas.
I think we don't have any idea what's going to happen, and that's scary.
From the end of March to the end of July, Campbell says a combination of the eviction moratorium plus a federal housing boost to unemployment checks and stimulus money kept many of the most vulnerable people from being evicted when they fell behind on rent because they lost work or got sick. What the moratorium didn't do...
it didn't itself forgive a tenant's contractual obligation to pay a rent. They still owe that rent.
By late July, more than a quarter of Americans had already missed a rent or mortgage payment, and a third of renters weren't sure that they could pay in August. Landlords in CARES Act-protected properties were free to start the eviction process. And that started a 30-day countdown, which ended this week.
The CARES Act was the dam, and instead of Congress adding to it or keeping it up, they've decided to knock it down, and so that wave is coming.
The National Low-Income Housing Coalition estimates that 30 to 40 million people in the U.S. are vulnerable to eviction this year. To put that in context, during the whole of the Great Recession, about 10 million people were foreclosed upon or evicted.
We're on the precipice of a housing crisis of really epic proportions that rivals really the Great Depression. And that's on top of, right, what is a public health crisis?
Lisa Alexander is a professor at Texas A&M School of Law who studies federal housing policy. She says new federal protections for renters are stuck in limbo as Congress and the White House remain at loggerheads over the next round of coronavirus relief. Democrats want more help for renters, Republicans not as much. And while the president has publicly supported extending the ban on residential evictions, the executive order he signed didn't actually do that.
Therefore, many people, if they're not living in a state or a county or a city that has enacted some kind of protection, they can be evicted now.
That describes most people in Texas, where a shortage of affordable housing meant nearly half of all renters were already paying more than they could afford before the pandemic hit. And Alexander says a history of racist housing policies have rendered people of color particularly vulnerable to eviction.
What has happened is that COVID-19 has just exacerbated the problems that existed before.
Landlords say extending an eviction moratorium just passes the burden of America's affordable housing shortage onto them. Ian Mattingly runs LumaCorps, which operates 6,000 rental units in Texas. He says rental housing is a $1 trillion a year industry.
Even if it's only 15 or 20% of your residents who are not paying rent, I dare you to name an industry in the world that can take a 20% reduction in income and not have effects throughout the entirety of the economy.
Mattingly also heads the Apartment Association of Greater Dallas, and he's optimistic Congress will send more help. Meanwhile, he says landlords are working with people as much as they can.
I've seen members doing things that 6 or 9 months ago would probably have been unthinkable as far as payment reductions, deferrals, waiving late fees, and deferring evictions.
With all the talk of millions of looming evictions, legal aid lawyer Stuart Campbell says it's easy to lose sight of what evictions do to individual families.
It's a very traumatic experience when a man with a gun and a badge shows up after putting a red placard on your door and says, either you leave or I put you in cuffs and forcibly remove you from your home. And by the way, the landlord's here with a couple movers to put all your stuff on the curb.
As things stand right now, that's a trauma that one out of every 10 Texans could experience in the next few months. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Millions of Americans have been at real risk of eviction over the past few months. Many of those people have now been given a lifeline. In a dramatic move, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is ordering a halt on evictions across the country through the end of this year. NPR's Chris Arnold is reporting on this and joins us now. Chris, good morning. So this is a huge move by the CDC. It doesn't, though, seem on its face like something the agency would have the power to do.
Hey, Rachel. Yes. So, I mean, you might think that because especially so far during this pandemic, we've seen nothing very forceful from the CDC. It's been criticized for having voluntary guidance that lets states and businesses kind of do whatever they want. If that's the CDC sort of, you know, walking on little kitty cat feet, this, though, is the CDC booming its feet like Paul Bunyan or something and doing something much more dramatic. And the CDC says it does have the authority under the Public Health Service Act in 1944 that gives the government broad power to stem the spread of communicable diseases. Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, the basic idea, of course, is that forcing people out into homeless shelters or crammed together living with relatives, that is very likely to get a lot more people sick.
So who does this eviction ban apply to specifically?
All right. Well, quickly, to qualify, renters have to sign a declaration saying that they tried to get unemployment benefits or other kinds of support, that they'll make partial payments as much as they can afford to their landlord. They can't make more than about $100,000 a year, or twice that if you file jointly. And that if you're evicted, you have no other option than homelessness or living with more people in close proximity.
Which would increase the risk, which is exactly what they're trying to avoid. So how many people are we talking about? How many people would this affect?
We are talking about a lot of people. One estimate from the National Low Income Housing Coalition is 30 to 40 million people in 17 million households or families were at risk of losing their home by the end of the year if something like this wasn't done. Diane Yentel is the CEO of the group, and I spoke to her last night.
Well, my reaction is a feeling of tremendous relief. I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary and unprecedented measure that the White House is taking that will save lives and prevent tens of millions of people from losing their homes in the middle of a pandemic.
But she says also Congress or the White House should have done this months ago, and instead we've had this crazy quilt patchwork of federal, state, local moratoriums. Lots of people weren't covered, and thousands of people have already been evicted.
What are you hearing from landlords about this, Chris?
Well, in short, the landlords are saying, well, who's supposed to pay for this? Democrats in Congress had plans for a moratorium, but along with that was $100 billion of assistance to renters and landlords to pay for that. That is not a part of this order. I spoke to Greg Brown. He's with the National Apartment Association.
We're really concerned about this because if the moratorium is put in place, rents are not paid, but the owners continue to have to meet their financial obligations. And how are they supposed to do that? Who's going to help them pay their bills?
And it's not just landlords who want the rental assistance. Diane Yentel, who we heard from, she too says, look, this needs to be coupled with federal money to pay for missed rent.
It's a half measure. Eviction moratoriums on their own create a financial cliff for renters to fall off of when those moratoriums eventually expire and back rent is due and renters are no more able to pay it then than they were at the beginning of the pandemic.
And we should say all this puts pressure on lawmakers to make a deal and come up with some money to pay and help people struggling during the pandemic.
NPR's Chris Arnold, thank you.
You're welcome.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The answer to the question, how many people have contracted the coronavirus in Texas? Well, it depends on who you ask. State health authorities will give you one number. Individual counties will give you another. The discrepancy makes it difficult, to say the least, when it comes to gauging exactly how the virus has affected the Lone Star State, especially when Texas's modest number of contact tracers can't keep up with all the cases that come across their desk. Here to tell us more about what's behind all this, Alexandra Villarreal. She is a Texas-based freelance reporter for The Guardian. Alexandra, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been reporting on data dumps in the past, you know, sort of backlogs of information about who's getting the coronavirus and where. You've been writing about the problems we're having with data reporting and contact tracing. How would you contrast how contact tracing is supposed to work versus how it's actually happening here in Texas?
Well, when Governor Greg Abbott talked about the state's contact tracing effort in late April, as he announced Texas could begin the process of reopening, he actually used very specific language. He said that the contact tracing effort in Texas would box in the expansion of COVID-19. Contact tracers make contact with new cases, and then they trace their recent interactions to see who may have been exposed. So ideally, they're making contact quickly enough to stem infections within the community and avoid any major outbreaks. But during a nightmarish summer here in Texas, that apparatus fell apart, at least on the local level in some of the hardest hit communities. One county judge described what contact tracers in her area were doing during an inundation of cases earlier this summer as a reverse alert, which is obviously less effective. Part of that is turnarounds for testing. As Harvard professor of global health Ashish Jha told me, test results that come back after more than 72 hours are essentially useless for contact tracing. Tests are turning around quicker now, but the Texas Department of State Health Services said they still take 2 to 3 days to get results. And then just on the statewide effort, they turn around and contact new cases within about 24 hours. So altogether, that's right at the threshold of relevance, if not after.
Well, if that's happening, is it, I mean, it sounds like a lot of this data, that it's useless after that 72-hour mark passes. And yet, as I understand it, there are, what, 4,000 contact tracers in Texas, and many of those contact tracers already feel overwhelmed. Is this all for naught?
So it's not all for naught. There are just under 4,000 contact tracers, about half of them at local health departments, according to Texas Department of State Health Services, in the state of Texas as of last week. And even at the height of the pandemic here in Texas, both JAW and the Department of State Health Services made the point to say that any infections that are caught matter to the individuals. And if you can bring down that percentage of infections by even 20%, that is significant. It's just not the sort of cure-all or the solve that Governor Abbott made it seem when he announced reopening.
What did experts tell you about what Texas needs to fix? Is it in the reporting of the data at the local level? Do we need more contact tracers? As a practical matter, what needs to be done to get these local figures and state figures in line in a way that can actually make a difference?
Sure. What I heard about the discrepancies in data is that they are inherent to the way that the data is being collected. And so, for example, with fatalities, the state is using death certificates, whereas counties are relying on local reports from their hospital systems, et cetera. And so those discrepancies exist because of the methodology. And so it would take changing the methodology to have them align. Now, what I was told by Ashish Jha, the Harvard professor, was that he would likely rely more on the county data. And across the board, you know, counties talked about they trusted their data more just because it was usually more updated and more exact to their situation. So I don't know how exactly to align that data just because it is a methodological difference. But in terms of which numbers to trust, most experts seem to be leaning on that county data that I spoke to.
Alexandra Villarreal has been reporting on this story for The Guardian. We'll have a link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Alexandra, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Summer is a season for state and county fairs, or at least normally it is. The threat of COVID-19 has canceled or postponed the vast majority of fairs across the U.S., but many are finding ways to continue their agricultural mission. From Colorado Public Radio, Stina Sieg has the story.
The sheep and goats, pigs and cows, lounging in the shade of this covered outdoor arena have no idea the strange times we're living through. Or that there aren't any carnival rides, funnel cake stands, or crowds at this year's Mesa County Fair.
I didn't think they were going to have one, you know, because of the coronavirus and stuff.
Harold Stafford, a fresh-faced 9-year-old in jeans and a red t-shirt, brought his 2 sheep.
Bullet and Jack.
Here to compete for ribbons and be auctioned off. It's all possible because Colorado's agriculture commissioner deems livestock shows and sales essential, says Melissa Wannenberg, who runs the county's 4-H program.
We were very aware that when we were given the okay to do this, if we had a huge spike in cases, that we would get shut down.
But Mesa County, like many rural areas in Colorado, has a coronavirus infection rate that's much lower than the state's big cities. Wannenberg says that kids in 4-H and Future Farmers of America use money from selling their livestock to buy next year's animals, and even to save for college. Without this summer's competitions and sales,
I think it would have been a huge hole in an already kind of tough year.
Across the country, even fairs in areas hardest hit by coronavirus are doing their best to still hold youth livestock shows, with permission from local health departments. For some, that means shows completely online. But here in Mesa County, the animal competitions are pretty much the same, just with about 20% fewer kids. 12-year-old Danielle Long says she's glad to be here with Rocco, her white and black lamb. But she's also kind of sad.
Because we've just became really close friends.
With school out since spring, they've spent so much time together, which will end as the fair does.
It's going to be really hard when he leaves, but I will get over it when I get my next plan.
Also at the fairgrounds is a cavernous barn filled with cattle and giant fans keeping them cool. 18-year-old Antonio Trejo Alvarez is cleaning up the hooves of his final 4-H steer.
He weighs as much as a truck.
And he thinks the big, nameless guy will go far in his competition. It would be a good end to Trejo's 11 years in 4-H, starting with lambs.
I've probably hand-raised more sheep than math homework assignments I've turned in.
Trejo surrounded by that earthy, pungent smell of manure. He calls it homey.
There's people out and about. They're taking care of their animals. They're getting stuff done. It's a nice feeling, and it's a nice smell.
A whiff of something normal in a time so alien. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
That is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up next, our national news from the USA Today program, and then we'll have our local news program at 3 o'clock. Here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading then. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Peyton says Midland is ready for what's next. Midland ISD salaries top average across Texas and nation. COVID cases down from early August peak. From the Odessa American, DA wants excessive force review. Sheriff says DA statement makes zero sense. Compass starts year in person. And City Council District 2, Thompson touts business background. Those articles and more will bring you at 3 o'clock this afternoon. At 6 tonight, the Wall Street Journal. And at 7 o'clock tonight is our Centers Solutions podcast with Christy Edwards and Melanie Size from Centers for Children and Families, as well as our executive director at the Recording Library, Bailey Hennis. Tonight's program is a rebroadcast you may have missed earlier. This was their second podcast that they did after the pandemic began, and it's focused on the economy specific to the Permian Basin, on the oil industry, and the job losses that we've been experiencing here in the basin. They'll be speaking about if you are one who has been affected, how to cope, as well as if you know someone. And so many of us know at least one person who has been laid off during the pandemic, it seems like, how to help them as well. Once again, the Center's Solution. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today. Followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 83 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Liz Hill, and this is your USA Today. First article of the morning is titled, Trump Administration Announces Nationwide Eviction Moratorium Through the End of the Year. Written by John Fritz and Nicholas Wu. Relying on a public health law intended to prevent the spread of an illness, the Trump administration said Tuesday it is implementing a national 4-month moratorium on residential evictions. The moratorium, announced by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was the latest measure by the administration to get a handle on the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, absent an agreement with Congress on a more far-reaching package that would have the force of law. To stop evictions, health officials are relying on the 1944 Public Health Service Act, which gives the administration broad quarantine powers. The moratorium, which will run through December 31st, applies to individuals earning less than $99,000 a year and who are unable to make rent or housing payments. President Trump is committed to helping hardworking Americans stay in their homes and combating the spread of the coronavirus, White House spokesman Brian Morgenstern told reporters Tuesday. The move drew a mixed reaction from